If you start to get nervous, just picture me in my underwear, and you'll feel a lot better. You know, one of my favorite things. First of all, this is like my favorite kind of discussion meeting. I mean, it's the topic is me, and I get to talk the whole time. And I think every discussion meeting ought to be like that. It's a real treat to be speaking here tonight. It's been a while since I've spoken here at this group, although I do get to do the foundation meeting once in a while. But it's a real treat because of how much I love this group and how much this group has done for me. And I feel like, you know, when I speak or when I do something, it's like I've just paid back such a little piece of the debt that I owe to this group. And so it's a real honor for me to be here. I've been in lots and lots of groups over the last 20-something years, and I've never felt like I owed a group much like I owe this one. So glad to be here. My story is probably not a heck of a lot different than a lot of people's, except I don't remember it very well. I started drinking it at a very, very young age, and was probably drinking on a regular basis by the time I was 12, and after a couple years, I wasn't doing well in school. I wasn't going to school. I wasn't getting along at home. I was in conflict. I was living with my father, and we just couldn't agree on the school attendance policy. We couldn't agree on the curfew. We couldn't agree on the smoking policy. There were just a lot of issues that we couldn't come to terms on, and I was at odds with him, and he was kind of the one that made the rules. He was a little bit bigger than I was, as far as he could tell, I needed to go away. I was too much for him to handle, and so I, when I was my first few months of freshman year in high school, I got sent away to my first long term, what they called residential treatment centers, which are just basically places for screwed up kids. Back in the 70s and 80s. The insurance companies would just pay for these places like crazy, and that's what they did with us. They sent us away, and that first one I went to was for 16 months, and I remember I was there for about a day and a half, and I couldn't get my hands on any booze. I mean, I could not drink, and I slid downhill so fast. It was just unbelievable. I was so incredibly miserable that the whole time I was there, and they'd give my dad progress reports, and Mr. Pick, he's a nice kid and he's well behaved, but he's just not showing much improvement. He's still depressed and he's not responding to anything, and after a while, I just kind of overstayed it and got sent home, and I lasted for another 11 months before I was off to the next one, and I went to a place for 4 months in Chicago where I lived, and then they sent me to another place for 16 months, which is how I ended up in Texas. So I spent, between ages 14 and 18, I spent a total of 36 months locked away in these places because of my alcoholism. But we didn't call it that. I mean, not that I would have been interested in talking about it. But it was, they called it depression and a couple of disorders, and they tried to treat me with antidepressants and group therapy, and we'd sit around in groups every day, and it was like there were maybe a dozen of us, and every day someone was going to have to cry in order for us to get these people to end the group. I mean, someone had to break down and cry, And I was always the toughest cookie to crack. It's like, okay, Tom, you haven't said anything in 3 months, and we got to hear from you. And And man, I would just fight these people and fight these people, and I didn't understand what was going on with me. They didn't understand what was the matter with me, and it was just the worst time of my life. Not so much being locked up, but just not being able to drink. It just made me miserable. And then the last place was in Austin, Texas, and I decided to stay down there after I left instead of going home to Chicago. You know, Chicago was the scene of the crime, and it didn't really seem to make sense to go home. I had nothing going for me there, and I was afraid if I went back home, I'd end up in another place again. At least you know, no one could really see what I was doing, and so it just made sense to stay there. And I don't know if any of you have ever drank in Austin. You can't get sober there. I drank heavily, and you know, and I was working at the Austin State Hospital, and you know, we worked 3 to 11 shift, and it was, you know, 8 hours of tackling and shackling, and then we'd go out and get screwed up every night and, you know, sleep in and get up at, you know, 1 in the afternoon and do it all over again. And it was just the coolest job you could possibly have if you're going to drink. It was just perfect. And, but after a couple of years, things just hit the wall. I was done drinking, but I couldn't get sober. I'd worked in the psych hospitals down there, not just the state, but some other places. And the thought of checking myself into one of the places that I've worked at or that I've got friends that work at just freaked me out. And I couldn't get sober when I wanted to get sober. And long story short, I went back to Chicago, and my dad helped me get into this place. And on my 23rd birthday, I left there and headed back to Austin with a set of instructions. And you guys can, you know, certainly imagine what they were. You know, go to 90 meetings in 90 days and get a sponsor and get some phone numbers, make friends, go out and do stuff with people, go to the dances, you know, play sober softball, make coffee, do whatever. And so my first full day home, I went to a meeting, and I loved it. It was a discussion meeting. And I met a lot of really cool people there, people that were like me, people I could relate to, and you know, some of these people were people that I would actually party with. I mean, you know, cool people. And there's some of you people I wouldn't spend a minute drinking with you. But there were quite a few people there that I would. And I felt like I was at home, and the meetings were somewhat interesting at first. You know, it was you know, mostly topic meetings, and people would talk about whatever they were going to talk about. I mean, sometimes the first couple of people would stay on topic, but it would always veer off into some direction, and you know, but it was interesting. I'd listen to people talk about their problems, and you kind of want to go back the next day or the next week to hear how things are unfolding in their lives. And you know, and after like 10 years of this, I'm ready to blow my brains out. It's just killing me. I'd gotten a sponsor right away. I got the there's this one guy who sponsored all the cool people, and I thought, well, I'm cool, so that's who my sponsor needs to be. And this, I mean, this guy loved me. He wanted the best for me, and we did took some little stab at the steps. You know, one of the problems was that he didn't understand what the big book said. I mean, we just didn't talk about it. We didn't talk about what the literature says. We didn't talk about what the program really is, and so we just kind of picked up this, what I like to call, hearsay AA, where it just kind of gets passed on word of mouth, and until, you know, after 30, 40, 50 years of this stuff, it gets a little goofy, and it gets a little off track, and we start trying to improve things and add some clever twists to what we're doing, make up some interesting things that are designed to shield us from the first drink, and none of us knew any better. I know my sponsor didn't. If he did, he would have done something about it. And so, you know, I had a sponsor. I was told to call him whenever I felt like drinking, which I did. I was told to pick up newcomers and take them to meetings. You know, during the first 4 or 5 years, I took a meeting to a couple of different detox centers down there, and I would just get up and do just, you know, some regular old AA talk, just try to give them some hope and make them laugh a little bit, but nothing with any depth or weight, really. I didn't have a whole lot of experience to share about the steps. But you know, I went down and I did it, and I made a bunch of friends, and I was plugged in, and I was going to, you know, 5, 6, 7 meetings a week. Even in the beginning, it was, you know, 10 or 12. I mean, I just bought into everything, and I did it. And you know, I'd love to tell you, you know, it was completely miserable, but sometimes it wasn't. You know, sometimes it was okay. And there were a lot of people who are very dear to my heart today, who I'm still friends with. You know, some of you guys know Charlie Parker down in Austin, and Tommy, and a few other guys. I mean, these guys did everything they possibly could do to help me. Everything they knew how to do, they did. And they didn't hesitate, and they did it lovingly and without anything, you know, being expected in return. We just didn't have the recipe. We just didn't have the formula for how to do this stuff. But we were all trying our best, and that's, you know, that's really about all I can say about that. I remember I finished college. I came in. I had a GED, and I, you know, UT was in my backyard. And I decided after, you know, 5 or 6 years of being sober to go back to school. And I got a bachelor's in accounting and a master's in accounting, which means that I can do algebra with dollar signs. That's, you know, I'm not using it today. Thank God. I tried it. I hated it. It sucks. But, you know, I'd managed to arrange some things in my life the way I thought they needed to be arranged in order for me to be happy. You know, I'd gotten married. We adopted our son when he was a few days old. You know, got the college degree. You know, moved to Plano, Texas. Bought the house. Had the job with the Big Six accounting firm. And, you know, and everything was groovy. And in spite of the fact that everything was just the way I wanted it or had pictured it when I was a little kid, I was still pretty unhappy. You know, I'm still going to 4 or 5 meetings a week, and, you know, all my friends are in AA, and, you know, I married an AA girl, and, you know, my whole life is either AA or work or my wife and kid. And I remember I was in this meeting. Some of you may have heard me talk about this. I probably had about 15 years, and it was a discussion meeting. It was a men's meeting, and the chairperson was calling on people. It wasn't like, you know, you just say, you know, you talk when you want to talk. He was calling on people, and you know, when you've got a bunch of years in the program, you're getting called on. You know, they think you got something to say, and I knew my time was coming, but I was distracted, and I was thinking about other stuff, and so when by the time they got to me, I wasn't prepared. I hadn't worked on what I was going to say in the event that I was called on, and I wasn't listening to anybody else, so I couldn't really tell you, you know, what the topic was. And so I decided, well, I'm just going to tell these people the truth. And I said, my name's Tom, I'm an alcoholic. And they all said, hi, Tom. And I said, you know, I don't want to freak anybody out. I don't want to scare any new people or scare anybody else. But, you know, I got 15 years, and I feel like I'm going to drink again. And I don't think it's going to be today or tomorrow or this week. Probably not this month. Maybe not even this year. But I'm on this path, and I don't know what to do. I don't know how to get off. You know, I don't know what to do. And you know, the rest of the meeting, they kind of shared at me and gave me a little advice during the meeting. Then after the meeting, they came up and hugged me and told me they loved me. And these are my friends. I'm not, you know, I mean, these aren't bad people. These are my buddies. And they told me that they loved me and told me that they were glad that I shared that and that I let them in on what was going on. And they told me that I needed to start coming to the meetings on time. See, how it works was just driving me crazy. And that was 10 minutes. I didn't think that I needed to be there. You know? And I'd leave 10 minutes early, right when the call for the burning desire, because it's going to be that same old SOB that's been using the burning desire to get the last share in for, you know, 5 or 6 years. So I'm doing 40 minutes of meeting, and it's about all I can stand. And these guys are telling me, you need to double up in your meetings. I'm like, oh, my God. If doubling up on these meetings is going to save my life, I'm dead. I'm going to die. I can't do it. You know, I'm going to 3 or 4 a week right now. I can't. The thought of going to 6 or 8 just freaks me out. I can't do it. And I didn't. And a couple years later, the thought of drinking came into my head. And, you know, I started going through everything that I had heard that I should do if that ever comes up. I'll be honest with you, I didn't think it had ever happened. It hadn't happened in 16 years, 16 and a half years at that point. And so I started thinking about what the mid-80s were like, what it was like when I first got sober. And I, you know, frankly, I got sober because I thought I couldn't live more than a month or two if I kept going. And I didn't come in here on a winning streak. And I didn't think I could go back and live through it again for very long. Then I started thinking about all the bad stuff that would happen if I were to drink. You know, I'd lose my wife, my kid, my business, my family, my million friends in AA, my sobriety date, which I was so proud of, my life. And I was like, no way, there's no way I'm going to drink. And in probably less than an hour, I was drinking. And man, I would love to tell you guys that, I, you know, at some point I just said, screw it, I'm drinking. But that did not happen. What happened was, is I decided not to drink, and I drank. And it's like this mental blank spot that the Big Book talks about. I didn't slip into a coma. I wasn't just out of my mind. It's just that it just started happening, and I couldn't make it not happen. It's like a sober blackout. You know, I was functioning. I was going at green lights and stopping at red lights. I mean, nothing weird, but I couldn't keep myself from drinking. I absolutely could not do it. And when I drank, man, I got to tell you, besides, you know, being drunk, I mean, I was unbelievably freaked out. It's like, how in the hell did this happen? You know, I tried doing what people told me to do. You know, I've probably banked, you know, 5 or 6 thousand meetings. You know, I couldn't call my sponsor. I couldn't call anybody before I drank. I couldn't look at a meeting schedule and get myself to a meeting. I couldn't choose not to drink and get away with it. And there I was drunk. And I didn't like it. And I tried to get sober. I tried going back to my home group. And I talked to my sponsor, and I tried to get him to help me get sober. And it didn't work. You know, I went back to my group, and it's, you know, it's one of these groups where the only new people we ever saw were people that had just come out of treatment, and so they're all shiny and cleaned up, and they're not really circling the drain, and we would just tell them to do 90 and 90, and a lot of them could get away with it, and so we weren't really used to dealing with wet drunks and helping them get sober. And also, I think maybe some of these folks kind of saw themselves in me, and it might have made them a little uncomfortable to see me drunk, and so they just kind of avoided me like crazy, and you know, I got a different sponsor, and that didn't work, and I just felt like I was going to die. I felt like I would never get AA again. You know, I'd always heard that people with a lot of time, when they go back out, they rarely come back. And that had been my observation. I mean, I'd witnessed that firsthand a million times. And I thought I was going to be one of those guys. And I almost gave up. In fact, I did. I mean, it's just kind of a freak thing that I decided to get some help. I mean, my wife just cried at the right time. And I decided to try to do something, and I did, and I discovered some people that that knew the big book and knew how to explain what the problem was to me. See, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous thinking that step one meant that I've got a drinking problem, and when I drink, bad stuff happens. You know, that wasn't too big of a limb to go out on. I mean, you know, it was pretty obvious that bad stuff happens when I drink. But you know, here I was, I had 30 days, I go back to Austin, I start making friends and going to the meetings and dating the AA girls and getting involved and doing all this stuff, and I'm not drinking, and the bad stuff's not happening, and I'm thinking, you know, my problem is solved. You know, the message I got about the steps is you work the steps on things. Well, my mom died, so I'm going to work the steps on that. My girlfriend left me, I'm going to work on the steps on that. I didn't have anything to work the steps on. Nothing bad was happening. And so there's no need to resort to the steps. And so my motivation to do the steps, it just didn't exist. You know, I thought that going to meetings was a good idea, and it made sense, and, you know, it was fun, and I could do it and do it perfectly. All you got to do is show up on time and leave on time, and you've attended a perfect meeting. And I could pull that off till the end. And so I never understood what the problem really was. And because of that, the treatment never made any sense to me. And then I found, you know, I found these guys who understood the book and explained my problem to me. And in all these little dots that have been scattered in my head that I've always been trying to line up started to get lined up, and they started to make sense. You know, I used to think that the steps were all about, you know, turning me into a good boy and teaching me how to play well with others and kiss and make up with everybody and all this other crap. And I'm thinking, you know, I did kiss and make up with those that I needed to make my life easier. And I was a nice boy, and I did play well with the people that I liked. And, you know, I don't need this stuff. It's just, you know, I'll dabble at it, but, you know, I mean, I'm just, you know, I could take it or leave it. And what I found out was that the steps are designed specifically to identify and block and remove everything that's blocking me from God. See, I didn't understand this powerlessness thing. I thought that when I got that desire chip and I said, my name's Tom and I'm an alcoholic, that I took step one. I thought that was my step one experience, that I was admitting that I was powerless over alcohol and all this other stuff, when the truth was is I had absolutely no idea what it meant to be powerless over alcohol. I just went along with it. You know, everybody else is. I guess I must be too. But I didn't understand what it meant about, you know, lack of power over choice and control. And you know, for those of you who are checking this group out for the first time or are new and haven't really heard about step one, I mean, basically when we say we're powerless over two things, choice and control. When I drink, I cannot control how much I'm going to drink. Even when I was 10 or 11 years old, I would drink and I would drink and drink and drink and drink until I passed out or fell asleep or got arrested or, you know, something. And I would do this every single time. I never had a period where I crossed a line into not having control of this. I started off out of control and just stayed that way my whole life. And the deal is this alcohol, when I put it in my body, it triggers a craving for more alcohol. Okay? Now, I've been to 5,000 or 6,000 AA meetings. I'd never heard anybody talk about that stuff. We're always talking about the cat crapping on the carpet or the pool boy putting too much chlorine in the pool or just crazy stuff. But there wasn't time to talk about, you know, the doctor's opinion or the steps or God or working with others. We got problems to work on. In the powerlessness over choice, I really missed that whole lesson. I really missed that lesson. What the literature tells me and what the experience of the first 100 members of AA shows me that they documented in the basic text of our fellowship is that I cannot choose not to drink. No matter how bad I need to not be drinking, no matter how bad I want to not drink, no matter how bad people are begging me not to drink, no matter if I'm going to die with my next drink, I cannot keep myself from that first drink. I cannot do it for any length of time. Some people can go a week or a month. Some people can go a few months. I can go 18 hours, and that's about as good as it gets. before the memory and all the shame and all that stuff of what happened the day before lose its impact on me. You know, I mean, you guys know what I'm talking about. It's just that I can't remember any of the stuff with enough force, like that day that I got drunk with 17 years. You know, why the hell is it that some guy with 17 years who's used to not drinking, who doesn't have any drinking buddies, who's successful in business, great wife, great kid, doesn't want to drink in the first place, why in the hell would he drink? It doesn't make sense. And the truth was is because I thought that I could choose not to drink. I thought by listening to my friends in the meetings that I could think through the drink, that I could think about the consequences and not drink. Well, let's think about that for a minute. If I can keep myself sober, if I can think through the drink and rely on all the bad stuff that happened and the memory of that stuff to keep me from picking up, am I powerless over alcohol? No. If I can keep myself sober, I still have power over alcohol. I can't take step one. If I can't take step one, I don't belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. The truth was is that I had no clue that when that time came, you know, and I didn't know when it was going to come, I wouldn't be able to choose not to do it. And that's why this thing is so deadly. That's why we die of this stuff. And there's the graveyards are full of people who were taught by people in AA that they could think through the drink or that they should think through the drink. And then when the time came, they tried it and it didn't work. Graveyards are full of those people, and it's, you know, it just breaks my heart to think about that, and to think about all the people that I've given instructions to go to 90 and think through the drink and all this other stuff. You know, we were just passing on some bogus information about what this program's all about, and you know, but once I understood that lack of power is my problem. The solution made sense. God is the solution. If I don't have power, I need power. And the only power that's ever going to work for me is a power greater than me, because I don't have power that's great enough to overcome this alcoholism. Well, when you put it like that, I'm interested in how the solution works. You know, how do I get to God? You know, I grew up in Chicago, and I know some of you have heard me say this, but we didn't have God in Chicago. Yeah, and I was here. I am sitting in these meetings with you Texas people, and you know, there's a church on every corner, and everybody's been going to church and doing all sorts of stuff, and you guys already have some kind of belief or some experience, and I am just inexperienced in this God stuff, and I would listen to you guys, and I would think, man, this is not for me. I am not going to get this thing. And I was right. I wasn't getting it. I was getting some pretty weird advice about how to connect with God, and I tried it and it wasn't working. But I just didn't understand this whole thing. You know, why is God the solution? And you know, when one understood what the problem was, God made sense of solution. And what I learned was, you know, the steps are designed to unblock us from God, from that source that's always been there in the first place. I just happened to be blocked from it. And so it was pretty easy for my sponsor now to get me to take these steps. And it's kind of interesting. I had heard about this group several years before I ever went back out. And I knew a guy that was coming here, and he knew what I was about, and he knew that I would love it here, because I tended to be somewhat vocal about the meetings I was sitting in, and so did he, and so we just kind of made friends, and he's like, dude, you've got to check out this meeting. I was like, what's it called? He said, Primary Purpose. So why? Well, it's, yeah, I mean, does it get better than this? He says, well, all they do is they study the big book, and they're sponsoring people, and they're taking meetings to other places, and you can't talk about yourself in the meeting. And I was like, dude, I love it. Where is it? Midway and Royal. I was like, oh God. I'm in Plano. You know, I would have to pass like 10 groups to get to it. I said, I'll tell you what, man, I'll check it out sometime. I'll give you a call and we'll go together. And of course, I never made that call. And I can't tell you what would have happened had I come. I think I probably would have fit in pretty well and thrown myself into it. But it wasn't until I drank again that I learned about this group. And I called that same guy and I said, "Hey, are you going to that primary purpose group still?" He says, "Yeah." I said, "Who's your sponsor?" I wasn't going to let this guy sponsor me. I mean, I watched him get sober, and he was an idiot. He said, "Well, this guy named Myers Raymer." And I said, "Is he pretty good?" And he's like, "Yeah." I said, "Well, cool. I'm going to ask him to sponsor me." And so I came up. It was a Tuesday night, and Myers was chairing the meeting, and you know, he got everybody to stand up that was able to sponsor, and he didn't stand up. It's like, this is not how I planned it. And I went up to him after the meeting, and I was like, "Hey, man, I had 17 years, and I went back out, and I need help. And I noticed you didn't stand up. Can you make an exception?" He's like, "Well, of course." And we went back in that room back there after the meeting, and we did the first three steps. And he gave me instructions on doing my fourth step, and he gave me about, you know, a day or two to do it. And I did it in a day or two. And, you know, within 2 weeks, I think it was like maybe 11 or 12 days, I'd gotten through the steps. And then we had that talk. He's like, "I'm not going to let you just sit in these meetings and hang out. You need to start working with other people." I was like, "Dude, I mean, you know, I'm just, my head is still messed up. I gotta relax and get my bearings." He's like, "You don't have time to relax. You need to find somebody to work with." And I believed him. And I had 3 weeks when I got my first guy to work with. And I did step work with that guy, and he stayed around for a little while and then decided that being sober wasn't for him, which I completely understand. But that was the beginning of all the cool stuff to come. And I started going down to the Salvation Army and, you know, taking two or three guys a night through step work down there. And we were just kicking butt and taking names and just having the greatest time of our lives. And as time wore on, I never quit doing this stuff. And I got more into prayer and meditation, and I got more into doing 10-step work. And I realized that step 10 was going to be the thing that kept me alive. You know, it's the thing that most people, even people that go to PPG, we're not, just because you're a member of PPG or you attend this group, that doesn't give you anything extra. There's no extra insulation. We've still got to do this work. And I guarantee you that the people that do go back out probably haven't been doing 10-step work. And so I pay real close attention to that. And I pound the table on that stuff with the guys that I work with because I know. Because I just know. I know how I get when I'm left unattended for a day or two. And my mind starts working and everybody starts messing up and I've got to judge everybody and all that stuff. I know what this stuff does, and so I'm pretty emphatic about it. And you know, I mean, the guys that I sponsor will certainly attest to that. But we're staying sober and they're doing the work and I'm doing the work and I hope that continues. You know, I got into prayer and meditation. And I, you know, for 17 years, even the day I drank, I said the third step prayer. Didn't really know what it meant. Had it memorized and had a friend of mine tell me that he'd never seen anybody drink that said the third step prayer that day. I was like, "Well, I can do that." And so that was my prayer life. And it was usually in the car. And that's just what I did. And what I learned is, I'm not going to ask you to show any hands, but if you're not meditating, you're missing a huge piece of this puzzle. You're missing a huge part of this deal. You know, God loves to hear from us. You know, He thinks it's cute when I say, "Hey, God, it's me." You know, Lottery Tom. You know. But He really digs it when I shut up. And He gets to do some talking. And that's what the meditation's for. And that's where I get quiet. And I empty my head of all these thoughts that I'm capable of having. And I allow myself to take in whatever He's going to put in there. And I don't see any flashes out of burning bushes. I don't hear any voices. what just happens is that, you know, sometime I'll run into a situation, and like the book promises, instead of being baffled about it, I'll have this intuitive thought, or I'll face a dilemma, and there will be a struggle between my will, which is going to be more fun, and God's will, which is going to get me what I want later. And that intuitive thought, that gut feeling, that instinct tells me to follow this path. And when I do, it's always good. And when I follow mine, 90% of the time, it's not that great. And I've started to trust it, and I've started to listen to it, and I've started to take it seriously. And I can't emphasize that enough. You know, back in the 30s and 40s, when AA was just at the top of its game, these guys were huge into meditation. It was a big thing back then, and it's kind of flip-flop now. You know, where you know, you can wander into any you know, AA group here in Dallas or LA or Chicago or anywhere, and ask people to raise their hands that day that meditated, and you're not going to see a whole lot of hands. You'll see a couple liars, a couple people that did it, and not everybody else. And so this stuff is real, real, real important. You know, you can take that to the bank. And then I got into sponsorship, and that changed everything for me. I'd sponsored people. I don't feel like I killed this guy, but there was a guy who came to me, an old friend of mine, wanted some help. I had about 5 years, and we had worked together and at the state hospital, and those are close quarters, and it was pretty dangerous, and you become really tight with the people you work with. And he called me up asking for help, and I was like, come on, man, let's go to a meeting. And he went to the meeting, was just disgusted with what he heard. It was just a big turnoff for him. He saw everybody as a bunch of babies and whiners and just bitching and moaning about stupid stuff. And on the way home, he was just griping at me, and I was like, buddy, you know, these people you're criticizing are the people that are going to save your life. You know, this is all we got to offer. You know, you need to go to some more meetings. And he went to some more meetings, and he went to some more meetings, and it was the same thing, just this arguing and complaining out of him. And it would get a little bit more heated, and he'd get a little bit more passionate about how much he didn't like it and wanted something else. And I didn't have anything else to offer this guy. All I had was, you know, go to meetings and call me if you feel like drinking. And then he wrote a suicide note and killed himself. You know, he told his mom to thank me for everything I did for him, and, you know, a few other things, and he killed himself because, you know, I didn't have the instructions for him to get sober. He walked into our meetings, and all he heard was people complaining about their lives. You know, all he wanted was to stay sober, and he wasn't hearing the solution. And it breaks my heart to think about that. But that was my sponsorship experience with new people. So pretty much from then on, the guys that I sponsored were all people that had a bunch of years whose sponsors had died or gone back out or something. And I would just inherit them, and they'd already be all grown up. You didn't have to toilet train them or anything. And I'd just, you know, pat them on the back when they were good and tell them to behave themselves when they're bad. And that was the extent of the sponsorship. That was my experience. But then when I had this psychic change because of taking the steps, it was unbelievable. I had this sense that I knew what to do with people. That for the first time in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew how to do my job, and I wanted to do it. I mean, Myers didn't have to browbeat me or twist my arm to get me to go help people. It's just the experience that I had was so quick and so profound that I just couldn't keep my mouth shut about it. And I wanted to do this, and I wanted to work with people. And, you know, I don't think I was the very best sponsor in the world, you know, my first couple of months. But I sure got a lot of practice, and, you know, and nobody died. And my sponsor taught me what I needed to do, and I would go to him, and he'd help me with certain situations with certain people, and we got through it, and I got better and better and better and better, and the cool thing is that I've been doing this, I don't know, four and a half years, And it hasn't worn off. It hasn't gone away. I enjoy working with new people as much today as I did, you know, back when I had a couple of months. I mean, it's just the coolest thing in the world. And I, you know, I mean, my objective is to always have somebody, at least one person, in the steps at any given time. I've had, you know, 8 people in the steps before. And, man, that is like, it's like being a Kennedy at happy hour, you know. It's just, there's just a lot to do. By the way, I won the Nobel Prize this year. Sponsorship. I learned pretty early on that my job as a sponsor is to get people from point A, from hopelessness, plugged into God as quick as I possibly can, to get them as independent of me and as dependent upon God as quick as I can. And my job is not to micromanage. My job is not to have people ask my permission to do things. My job is to listen to these 10 steps, listen to people when they're afraid and when they're selfish and dishonest and all this stuff, and point them back towards God. My job isn't to give an opinion about what they're doing or offer them an alternative behavior. My job is to tell them, buddy, I don't know. Take this to God and do what he tells you to do. And that's the right answer. Whether it's what I would do or not, you got to do what he's telling you to do. And I promise you, that has made life as a sponsor in AA so much easier. I see so many people struggling with this stuff, struggling to corral people and you know, herd these cats and try to get everybody acting right and behaving right, and it just makes them nuts. And if we really understand what we're supposed to be doing here, it's the coolest experience in the world. It's the coolest thing. I'm not responsible for coming up with any cool ideas. You know, that's a lot of work. I mean, you know, I come up with cool ideas, but they just don't turn out well. You know, why would I think that my ideas are going to help somebody else? This whole thing is about developing a relationship with God. And when I'm telling people to do what I think they need to do or get permission from me, then I've pushed God out of the picture. And I've put myself in that spot. I'm taking on the role of God. My ego is alive and active in full bloom. And I am separated from God when I'm doing that with the guys that I sponsor. And that's the last thing I want, is to be in the way of any of this stuff. You know, it just saddens me to see, you know, some of that stuff going on, but it's just very unnecessary. You know, the coolest experience I've ever had in this program has been with working with new people, working with guys who might have been around for a while, who are circling the drain at other groups, who come here, get a little glimmer of hope and decide to put all their ego off to the side and to take these steps. I mean, those are my heroes. My heroes are the guys that laid it out for me. And my heroes are the guys who, after 10 or 15 years of circling the drain, can come in here and put their egos on the shelf and say, I need help. That's about as cool as it gets. And I've gotten to work with a bunch of those guys. And it's just a blast to watch these guys go from miserable to happy in a matter of days. Not weeks, not months, but days. You know, it's funny, a lot of groups that I went to, you know, we talk about how, you know, you got to take your time with the steps and, you know, step a year, whatever that stuff is. You know, there's no way you can change that much in just a couple of weeks. Well, if the booze brings about a sense of ease and comfort, it brings about a psychic change in, let's say, half an hour, why would we think that God can't do the same thing? Is booze more powerful than God? I don't think so. I don't know it, but I don't think so. And it's just kind of crazy that we underestimate what he can do. you know, in terms of the stuff besides the alcohol, the depression and all these issues that we come in here with, I've seen people that have had the most awful things happen to them as kids and as young adults, abuse, incest. I mean, you just name it. I've seen it all, and I've seen these people take these steps and never be troubled by this stuff again. Never troubled by it again. They do not regret their past. They do not wish to shut the door on it. They get over it. And then I've seen people sit around for two decades talking in AA meetings about how awful their lives have been, and they never get better. You know, this, I really believe this, and some people will disagree with me, but I really believe that a lot of that stuff we carry around is spiritual in nature and not necessarily emotional or psychological. If it's emotional and psychological, trust me, after 36 months in those places, I would have been cured. It ain't that. It's spiritual in nature. It's a result of our ego, and the only way to get rid of that is to block everything, unblock everything that's blocking us from God, and get access to that power and get that psychic change that only He can give us. I cannot think my way out of feeling bad. I can't talk myself out of not having my past. I mean, I just can't run from it. But the only thing I've ever been able to do is take these steps and then use my story to engage other people and to attract other people to the solution that I found. And it's worked beautifully, and I've seen it work for people that are way sicker than I was. And you're out there. And so I know this stuff can work for anybody. I'm absolutely positive of it. You know, page 89 in our book talks about the thing that works the best. I'll read it to you. You don't have to. It says, practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with alcoholics. The only thing that will ensure immunity from drinking is intensive work with other alcoholics. What I'm doing tonight ain't it. This is not intensive work with other alcoholics. When I'm sitting down, eyeball to eyeball, face to face, across the table from a new guy, and I'm showing him how to take these steps out of the big book of AA and how to get to God as quick as he can get there so that he can have the coolest life possible. That's the intensive work with other alcoholics. That's the thing that ensures immunity. And so, you know, I think the big question is if that's the thing that does it, why would we do anything else? Why would we, you know, go to a bunch of meetings or write up trigger lists or avoid television commercials? I mean, I don't know. Whatever you guys do, why would we do anything but intensive work with other alcoholics? It's right here. The answer is right here. They didn't make this stuff up. They put down their experience. This is what they were doing. And then, you know, fast forward 70 years, and it's like, I'll do anything to keep from working with somebody. And part of the problem is that people are scared to sponsor. They're uncomfortable with it. They're afraid they're going to say the wrong thing. They're afraid they're going to do the wrong thing, or they don't have what it takes, or whatever. But the message that we have to send as sponsors is, all you got to do is show them how to do this stuff, and then keep sending them over to God when they have a problem. You know, and instead of thinking that they've got to, you know, figure out how to solve all their you know, new people's problems and how to be a good counselor and therapist, you don't have to do that. You just got to be able to read a book and point them back towards God. That's it. You're not going to kill anybody. Anybody can do this stuff. And your sponsor will help you, and you've got all sorts of people in the group that can help you. You know, nobody's going to die from a new person taking another new person through the steps. That's just not how this thing is designed. You know, and I think the real you know, benchmark that we got to look at when we're taking a look at what we're doing in this fellowship is, you know, if Bill Wilson or Dr. Bob had done what I'm doing, would there even be an AA? Well, not if you put it like that. No, seriously, if these guys had done what I'm doing, would there be an Alcoholics Anonymous? And let that be your measuring stick. you know, we've got a bunch of work to do. There's a whole bunch of new people that have no clue about this stuff, that have no clue what it means to be alcoholic or how to recover from this thing. But they're dying to hear it, and we've got a job to do. You know, luckily, you know, I'm involved in a group with you guys where that's just it's in the air. It's part of this atmosphere, and we just kind of do it. That's what makes this so cool. I really don't think that I could do it with the passion that I have if it weren't for the fact that I'm doing it with a couple hundred of my best friends. Just, you know, honestly, that's the fellowship I was seeking. I would go to those meetings with people that I'd known for 2 decades. I would feel like I had nothing in common with any of these folks. Some of them I didn't like. A lot of them I didn't like. Some of them I did. But as far as having stuff in common, yeah, we all kind of, you know, crashed and burned with booze, some more than others. Some were hard drinkers. But, you know, having this common solution is the whole deal. I can sit down and have a conversation with anybody in this room because we're doing the same solution. We're all working off the same page. And that is the fellowship that had been missing in my life, and I think is missing in the lives of many people who are trying to slug it out and trying to stay sober one ugly day at a time. You know, that's not what I'm here for, man. I've tried that. It just sucks. Let me read you something, guys. Read you guys something real quick, then we'll get out of here. I heard Chris Raymer read this one time. And a few years ago, I called him. I was like, buddy, email that to me. And I pull this out once in a while because I just think it's way cool. Now I pretty much tell people that I wrote it, but I didn't. It says, a drunk fell in a hole and couldn't get out. A businessman went by. The drunk called out for help. The businessman threw him some money and told him to get himself a ladder. But the drunk could not find the ladder in this hole he was in. A doctor walked by. The drunk said, help, I can't get out. The doctor gave him drugs and said, take this, it will relieve the pain. That doctor never walked by my hole. The drunk said thanks, but when the pills ran out, he was still in a hole. A renowned psychiatrist rode by and heard the drunk crying out for help. He stopped and said, how did you get there? Were you born there? Were you put there by your parents? Tell me about yourself. It will alleviate your sense of loneliness. So the drunk talked with him for an hour, then the psychiatrist had to leave, but said he'd be back next week. The drunk thanked him, but he was still in his hole. A priest came by, and the drunk called for help. The priest gave him a Bible and said, I'll say a prayer for you. He got down on his knees and prayed for the drunk, then left. The drunk was very grateful. He read the Bible, but he was still stuck in that hole. A recovered alcoholic happened to be walking by, and the drunk cried out, hey, help me, I'm stuck in this hole. Right away, the recovered alcoholic jumped in the hole with him. The drunk said, what are you doing? Now we're both stuck here. The recovered alcoholic said, it's okay. I've been here before. I know a way out. And that's what our job is, man. Nobody else can do this. We are the only ones that can reach other alcoholics. We're the only ones that can carry a message with any depth or any weight. We are the only ones that they will listen to. And it is everybody's job to take these steps, experience this psychic change, so that you can carry that message to the people that still suffer. It's all of our jobs, and it's a big job, and it's all hands on deck. And you know, if you're not doing the steps, get with somebody before you go home, get a sponsor and start doing this stuff. You know, get it done in a week or two. Just try it. You might be surprised at how cool it feels and how you might start to experience things that you never thought you'd ever get access to, that you thought was only available to those squares that went to church and did all the right stuff. Well, that's just a lie. It's open to all of us. Anyway, I appreciate you guys being here tonight and listening, and I hope I've helped somebody, and I'm certainly available for to sponsor somebody if anybody wants to grab me after the meeting. I'll be glad to help. Thanks.